Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Ursula Hackett of the New Books Network New Books in Public Policy podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Professor Roger Smith of the University of Pennsylvania and Professor Desmond King of the University of Oxford, authors of America's New Racial Battle Lines, Protect versus Repair, which was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2024. Welcome both to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ursula.
Well, I really enjoyed reading this absolutely powerful and theoretically rich book, which charts the rise of new lines of conflict in America's racial politics between, on the one hand, a protect alliance that is composed of conservatives who are promising to protect America's traditionalistic values versus a repair alliance, which seeks, on the other hand, pervasive egalitarian transformation of America's institutions in order to end systemic racism. And we're going to get on in a moment to the distinction between those two alliances and who's part of those alliances and what their goals might be. But Rogers, I wanted to start really with something that struck me with at the very beginning of your book, in which you describe, both of you, the transformative work that you have both done together since the early 2000s on race and politics. And I wondered whether you could tell us a little bit about that early work that you did together and how it led to your current book.
Yes. Both of us have always been concerned about civil rights issues. Both of us early in our careers, though, were relatively optimistic that we were on the path to racial progress in America. But events disillusioned us in that regard, and we began looking more closely at the dawn of the 21st century at the structure of American racial politics historically. And we came to the conclusion that racial policy debates have been in some ways distinctive from other issues. There have been overarching single issues that have shaped a whole host of subordinate ones and have given structure to American racial politics over time, and in fact, to the different eras of American political development. So we saw battles over enslaved labor systems as dominating racial policy issues up through the Civil War. Subsequently, after Reconstruction failed, battles over Jim Crow racial segregation dominated racial policy issues up through the 1960s. And then, in the 1970s, the main policy debates emerged as conservatives favoring colorblind policies that might gradually achieve greater integration over time, but not without any direct assistance to racial minorities. And liberals favored race-conscious policies to achieve integration into existing American institutions more rapidly. And we use that framework to analyze American racial politics for about 15 years. But then we began to see that things were changing, that we're entering a new era of racial politics. And that is the subject matter of the book.
Wonderful. And that takes us right up to these two racial policy alliances that you describe in this book, the Repair Alliance and the Protect Alliance. Now, listeners to this podcast might be more familiar with the terms liberal and conservative. Des, I wondered if you could tell us a bit about, you know, what a racial policy alliances are and how you define the Repair versus the Protect alliances.
Yeah, so the two alliances are very broad coalitions of groups who are either in favor of quite active measures for civil rights, the Repair Coalition, or really determined to retain things as they are at the moment, or even to reverse them, which is what we call the Protect Alliance. And these two alliances have obvious historical resonance. But they've regrouped in significant ways since 2008. the year in which Barack Obama was elected as president. So the Tea Party, as you know, began months after the Obama presidency started in 2009, and that feeds into this Protect alliance. We distinguish the two alliances in terms of organization, the groups, the networks that are involved in them, the funding that they have, and the ideology that they represent. So these three things separate the two groups. And the analysis in this book in America's New Racial Battle Lines is based on extensive interviews and data collection about these groups. And there's probably not too many surprises about the difference between them. You can imagine which kinds of groups. A lot of the groups associated with conservatism they're not opposed to civil rights, but they really don't want any federal action for them. And in some cases, they do want reversals, such as the major affirmative action decision by the Supreme Court last year, which for the Protect Alliance is a huge achievement and sets an agenda. They've been waiting a long time to get rid of affirmative action. For the Repair Alliance, the issue of reparations has been a longstanding one. And in the book, we talk about different ways in which that is developed. But the key development, event there was the voting in the Congress for a longstanding bill to investigate how reparations for America's history of enslavement would occur.
Let me add that one of the surprises that we found in researching the book is that many of the older conservative groups and liberal groups on racial policy issues have joined with a flood of new groups on each side to adopt novel racial policy stances. The older conservative groups set up in the latter part of the 20th century mostly emphasized that they wanted colorblind policies that would serve to slow the rate of racial change. They also thought it treated individuals more justly than race-conscious policies. But even the older conservative groups are not talking that much about colorblind principles anymore, except in some briefs in court cases. They're talking much more about how there's a need to protect traditionalist Americans and especially white Christian men against what they see as a hostile, militant, radical left. And so that's why we label them the Protect Alliances. And older groups like the Heritage Foundation have changed and are now fully on board with this agenda. Plus, there's been a plethora of new groups like the American First Policy Institute that are inspired by the Trump MAGA movement and advance this Protect agenda. On the other side, confidence that liberals had in the late 20th century that race-conscious measures could achieve integration into existing American institutions and that that would be sufficient racial progress, that was kind of exploded by the stagnation in economic progress for most African Americans in the early 21st century, especially after the 2008 financial collapse, which was very damaging for Black communities, and by many visual displays of police brutality that helped inspire the Black Lives Matter movement. And that moved the liberal progressive side to no longer emphasizing integration into existing institutions, but as you indicated at the outset, Ursula, they now have a view that American institutions display so much pervasive systemic structural racism that more radical repair is required. And again, there have been a lot of new groups devoted to this repair agenda, like the Movement for Black Lives and variety of new reparations groups. But older groups like the NAACP and the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, they've also moved more in this repair direction than in the past. And that's why we see this as a significantly new era with more polarized ideologies on each side of the political spectrum.
This is very powerful to hear about how these both new and old organizations are coming together to push the Protect Alliance in a more conservative direction and also the Repair Alliance in a more liberal direction. But one thing that struck me that you discuss as part of this book is about perhaps some of the asymmetries between the Protect Alliance and the Repair Alliance. And I think it'd be interesting for us to explore some of those dynamics as well. One of the things you suggest in the book is that it is harder for, in many ways, the Repair Alliance than it is for the Protect Alliance for a variety of different reasons. I wondered, Des, whether you could explore some of the reasons why that asymmetry might arise. And as a sort of supplementary question to that, whether you understand those asymmetries to be very substantial and whether you understand them to be intrinsic in some way to the difficulties of mobilizing and coordinating on the left versus mobilizing and coordinating on the right, or whether you see those as only contingently asymmetric in some way. So I wondered if you could flesh that out a bit for us.
Yeah, I think they're definitely not contingent. So we could talk about that. I think the history of the United States shows it's hard to enact civil rights reforms. And we argued in some of our previous work and in this paper that the history can be measured in terms of struggles about enslavement, segregation, voting rights, civil rights, police powers. And a lot of the institutions which are required to respond to enact civil rights laws have been controlled by the electorally and politically and institutionally by the Protect Alliance historically. So an example at the moment is it's proving so difficult to get through a Voting Rights Act that's been voted on in the House, but it's not, and in the Congress, but it's not going to go anywhere. It's not empowered, despite all the issues raised about voting in the last 10 years. At the very micro level, and something I know you know about, there are at school board levels. School boards are dominated by representatives of groups who are opposed to, in many cases, who are opposed to teaching about the nation's racist past, or using critical race theory, which we talk about a lot in the book. And those have become fault lines. And I think we can say systemically, local school boards as institutions have privileged a particular approach to the teaching of American history. So I think the asymmetries reflect, you're quite right, there are asymmetries, and I think they reflect the institutional and structural characteristics that we're analyzing in the book. I mean, there are some interesting developments. One of the things we found is that funding is vast on both sides of the, for both alliances, which was news to us, and we didn't realize this, but the particularly the Repair Alliance, the number of individuals and organizations and businesses that responded to the Ferguson death of Michael Brown in May 2014, and then much more so to the death of George Floyd in August 2020, produced a surge in contributions. We're in an era when there is a lot of extra money around because of Silicon Valley. There are people with huge amounts of money that they can contribute. For instance, historically, Black colleges and universities would not have survived without grants from some of these foundations in the last few years. So there's still, I think if you measure it, there's still a huge asymmetry, and there's a kind of built-in concern objection to the Repair Alliance, which is a feature of the political structures in the United States. I think we'd want to stress, and Rogers can say more here, I think we would want to stress the distinction between legacy groups and new groups. on both sides. And we came across this distinction. So on the civil rights side, on the repair side, the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been around since the beginning of the 20th century. It's a significant, powerful organization that mostly takes legal routes to try to address civil rights. Now there is a Black Lives Matter, or a movement for Black Lives, which is a very porous and large organization, but highly decentralized. And a lot of initiatives are happening at the local level. We discovered many local institutions, churches, for instance, who have engaged in reparations. So in addition to the on a very modest level, but they're doing it. So in addition to these sort of headline stories about Brown University investigating its slavery, and most recently Yale University producing this very substantial report on its engagement with enslavement, there is a lot going on at the local level. And we interviewed some of these organizations, and they were responding to what they see as this failure to advance a civil rights agenda since the 1970s and 1980s, despite legislation and policy. We're not exaggerating the alliances. We don't want to exaggerate their coherence or their internal coordination overly, but nonetheless, they are two significant groupings which we can identify at a whole range of levels in the political system. And the issues that they're fighting over are ones that really matter to each side. The memorialization issue, getting rid of Confederate flags, changing the name of buildings. Princeton University has famously dropped Woodrow Wilson from its School of Public Policy because of his involvement with segregation in the 1910s. And other changes like that are going on elsewhere. I think measuring the outcomes, i.e. who's been able to get measures passed, then there is the Protect Alliance has had more success. And they, for instance, because of the Trump administration, they've really got control of the Supreme Court, for instance. And the Supreme Court has been diluting civil rights since the 1980s. It's very hard to find any case in which they support an expansive view or uphold the need for tougher voting rights, for instance, or civil rights law. They've done the obverse. Major decision Shelby this century reversed some of the core rules in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the affirmative action case last year put pay to the use of affirmative action. The case concerned two university admissions, Harvard and University of North Carolina, but it's becoming an agenda for reversing diversity measures across a whole, most areas of American society would be their ambition, I think.
And let me add on the asymmetry point that it's not surprising, really, that because America was created by a coalition of property white Christian men, that the traditionalist forces that make up the Protect Alliance are well accustomed to working in cooperation with each other on behalf of their shared interests. And they did shape most American institutions from the outset. So it's true that a privileging of that set of interests is built into the American system to a large extent. Now, they also embraced Enlightenment ideals of universal human rights that have proven powerful instruments of transformative and egalitarian movements through U.S. history. But the asymmetry has always been there. And when it comes to coalition building, the Contemporary Repair Alliance is ambitiously trying to create an intersectional coalition. They're trying to make alliances between African Americans and Latinos and LGBTQ plus people and the disabled and variety of other groups, but these are not groups that are used to working together historically in political causes. And so that's why their coalition building challenges are greater. Now, some have read us as saying that the asymmetries are so great that the Protect Alliance is bound to prevail. And as Des has just emphasized, we do see them as predominant. They not only have controlled the Supreme Court for a long time, they have heightened that control recently, which led to the overturning of affirmative action, as well as abortion rights, which is a related civil rights issue in the American context. But it's also important to recognize that the Repair Alliance does have significant strengths. It's a real battle. Des mentioned the school board elections where initially the Protect Alliance won control of a large number of school boards and began banning books and banning critical race theory and also pushing for state legislation to control what gets taught about America's racial history and other subjects. And those efforts are continuing and they're powerful, but it is striking that precisely because there are many repair groups active at the local level, the most recent school board elections have gone the other way. In my home county of in Philadelphia, or next to my home county, Bucks County, a conservative group that came in was just overturned, and in some ways more strikingly, in the city of St. Louis, the region of the killings in Ferguson, the very conservative school board there was just thrown out in a local election, and people we would identify as repair advocates came into power. So it's important to recognize that while there's an asymmetry, and the Protect Alliance is more politically powerful, the contestation that has been visible in American racial politics all through our history is very much continuing today.
Wow, this is so rich and very interesting as well from both of you about these different dynamics. And I think I'm glad to hear you say on the point about symmetry that we need to really unpack that statement here. We don't want to talk just about in raw terms about asymmetries between these alliances, but also to think about the ways in which they might both be have some have achieved some success in terms of funding, for example, as well. You mentioned Des, and also to bring in the local and national, which I'd like to discuss in a moment. I mean, the point about the Supreme Court, I think, is absolutely right, and it's cases like Allen versus Milligan, which we heard last year, with the big majority minority district case that actually proves the rule. It's obviously the exception that proves the rule, that you've got this a court that is dedicated to dismantling some of the protections that we'd seen under the Voting Rights Act and Section 5, certainly, but also Section 2 as well. So that's a point very well taken. And I'm glad also, Rogers, that you mentioned intersectionality, because I'd like to ask you a bit about that in a moment. But first, let me come to the point that Des and also Rogers, you've both made about local and national and the role of federalism here. Because, of course, there is a lively discussion, not only in the scholarly arena, but I think in the national conversation, perhaps more broadly, about the role of states and of localities as being bulwarks against concerns about American democratic backsliding, or alternatively as sources of more sort of conservative voter suppression measures, perhaps in many places. And I wondered where you see, whether you could elaborate, Rogers, on the federal, state, and local dynamics that both of you outlined just now, and how that relates to your racial policy alliances framework.
it's now a commonplace in analyzing American politics to recognize that there is a division between rural and urban America, with rural America much more likely to be part of the Protect Alliance as we define it, and urban America much more part of Repair Alliance. And that means that less urban states, more rural dominated states, tend to be red states, and the those with large cities tend to be either divided purple states or blue states, and to support more repair policies. That means that in parts of the country, but not all of the country, there are intense battles over these racial policy issues. And in other parts of the country that are more homogenous, primarily rural dominated states, they are passing laws to consolidate the power of the Republican Party, which is now largely devoted to Protect agenda. Democrats do try and restructure things to benefit their power through districting and so forth when they can. But because the structure of the American federal system overrepresents the smaller, more rural states in our Congress and in our electoral college, it does mean that that federal structure is turning out to permit the Protect Alliance to have disproportionate power in relation to its share of the population in many regions and at the national level. And that's, again, another reason why we think the Protect Alliance is predominant. It is, you know, there are those who say these differences are so great that the U.S. may face another civil war. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Trump-supporting representative from Georgia, has said that, in fact, we should divide the country between the red and blue states. Neither of these scenarios is realistic from the standpoint of America's political geography, because Marjorie Taylor Greene's from Georgia. Georgia has two Democratic senators because it has a large city that does support repair type politicians. And one is an African-American guy who's been elected twice in Georgia recently. Plus the distribution of conservative Protect forces and progressive repair forces is not so regionally concentrated as the differences over enslaved labor were at the time of the Civil War. There isn't a plausible scenario in which red states battle blue states. That's not so reassuring, though, because there is, amongst the asymmetry, the fact that the Protect Alliance includes many, many more paramilitary groups that have indicated that they are willing to use violence to keep their side, which they know is a minority in the country and in many regions, to keep their side in power. The left does not have nearly so extensive a set of groups that are willing to use violence. Now, this hasn't always been true. In late 60s and early 1970s, there was a lot of violence on the left, the Weather Underground and so forth, that were deliberately pursuing bombing tactics. We don't have that on the left today, but we do have the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters on the right that are engaging in violence. And precisely because in many regions, we have cities that are bastions of repair supporters surrounded by areas that are Protect supporters, we have the potential and have seen violent demonstrations in which both sides clash. And one of the unfortunate scenarios that our analysis leads us to expect is a greater likelihood of recurring periodic violence in different parts of the region, of the country, in regions where this contestation is at its height.
Thank you for that. Des?
Can I just add? Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of repair advocates, civil rights advocates, waiting for the federal government is just going to take too long and too many barriers. And particularly on the issue of reparations, which is a very big topic and a very emotive one. And consequently, we found these very interesting initiatives at the local level. The city of Evanston in Illinois, which is the first city just north of Chicago, really part of Chicago, took this. It's a white majority, but has a substantial African American population, and its historic record on redlining, i.e., having discrimination against black homeowners being able to access mortgages in areas that they want, is pretty substantial and documented. And the current generation of city leaders took this initiative to use some of their revenues to allocate funds to African-American households who have been there for a certain while. And it's popular and it's been done. It's very small scale. It's a very small city. Evanston is quite famous for some of the people who've come from it, and the temperance movement began there, but it's nonetheless, substantial on that basis. And likewise, the former mayor of Los Angeles, Garcia, who's now America's ambassador to India, a Democrat, started this initiative with 10 other in LA and 10 other cities of setting up commissions to investigate reparations and to allocate money towards it. It's a very grassroots, although it's led by the mayor's office, these are very grassroots measures in that they appoint committees made up of local representatives from African-American communities and institutions to discuss in each case what is the way to go forward. This is below the radar. Evanston has got a lot of attention, but the LA initiative probably hasn't got as much attention. What did get a lot of attention was the recent California state legislature commission and report on a history of discrimination in the state and what reparations would look like, which proposed quite substantial sums on that basis. Now, reparations isn't a silver bullet, and it's not going to solve all these problems, but it's more substantial than is often recognized at the moment, and it's become part of the agenda. And it's very different to the sort of agenda being pushed by the protect militias, the language ideology that they use, the sorts of sort of racist ideas promoted in some recent mass shootings, which are very consequential and continuing in America. They again resonate with much earlier periods, but the fact that they're still there is very significant and does feed into, I'm glad you used the term backsliding, because it does lead into that. And we now have quite a bit of research by political scientists, disturbing research showing the percentage of American voters, mostly Republicans, but not exclusively so, who think it may be necessary to engage in violence at certain points to defend your party political view. And that was the logic behind January 6th, the insurrection then, that believing that it would be better to have an election stopped than to accept the democratic procedure that whoever loses leaves the office at the time.
Thank you, Des. And I think that we need to have I'd like to ask you a few things about this question of democratic backsliding, because I think it's such an important, it is the important issue here. But I would also like to pick up on your point about reparations. I think it's really fascinating for me to read all about these various different initiatives in your book that you document at the local level, where there really does seem to be some momentum for reparations. All of that was news to me, and I think it'd be very interesting to any readers out there. And I wondered whether, Rogers, you had any thoughts about how that reparations issue plays out when you consider it in connection with the rather large and substantial growth in the Latino population in the United States. I know that in your book you do come up with, find some interesting results with respect to the position of Latinos within the Protect or the Repair alliances. So I'd be interested to talk those through, because we see this really quite striking decrease in the number of white alone non-Hispanic Americans in the last census. And we see huge increases in the number of people identifying as multiracial, and we see really a very large increase in the number of people who identify as Hispanic or Latino, and that is actually driving a lot of the population growth that we've seen. So how does that the growth in the Latino population impact upon the reparations issue in particular, but also perhaps more broadly on your racial policy alliance framework?
Well, currently the Hispanic or Latino population in the U.S. Is a great challenge for the Repair Alliance. It is important to recognize, as the discussion has indicated, that we were finding much more evidence of reparations activity at the state and local levels than we anticipated, in that there are now some 19 cities that have reparations commissions, and they include predominantly white southern city, Asheville, North Carolina. It's not just places in the north like Evanston, Illinois. And there are three states that are authorizing state reparations commissions, in addition to California, New York, and Illinois. And these are very large states. So there is significant activity specifically for reparations and for a whole host of related local concerns, like electing prosecutors with reform views of the criminal justice system, like local health systems declaring racism to be damaging to communities' health in ways that they're trying to address. There is a lot going on the repair side that is flying under the radar for many observers. But at the same time, the specific aim of reparations is controversial, even within the Repair Alliance. More moderates members want to speak of racial equity initiatives, but not necessarily reparations. More radical ones speak of abolition of policing and immigration control forces. And the meaning of reparations has acquired novel content. Most often now, it does not mean one-time cash payments to individuals harmed by discriminatory systems. Now it means new systemic initiatives in the areas of housing and healthcare and criminal justice and environmental justice and many other topics. The scope of those reparations initiatives is something that many Americans find daunting. Most white Americans express opposition to reparations. So whether reparations can be a successful agenda for the Repair Coalition is very much in question. And Hispanic Americans play a significant role here, because they were a significant part of the race-conscious coalition that supported affirmative action policies. They expected that their communities would benefit from affirmative action policies. But when they hear reparations, they think that that is aimed mostly at African-Americans, especially African-Americans who are descended from enslaved people, and they think that for the most part, they will not benefit from those reparations initiatives. They fear that they may come at their expense. And that's another reason why the coalition building process on the repair side is more challenging than it is on the protect side. Although the way that many of these repair initiatives end up being structured, it could be that Latinos will see them as beneficial. So I don't want to make it sound like they're definitely out of the coalition. That is part of the politics that is going on right now.
Thank you. Des?
Just to add that they were much less Latino voters were much less involved in the campaign against affirmative action, whereas there was a significant representation of Asian Americans who feel excluded.
And especially Chinese Americans, yeah.
Especially Chinese Americans, yeah. And just to add two things. One is we perhaps should underline that one of the ways in which we found information about these local initiatives was from examining who had signed the H.R. 40 bill. And this is a bill which has been introduced into Congress since the 80s by first John Conyers and more recently Sheila Jackson Lee, both African-American representatives, the late John Conyers, and seeking to set up a commission to investigate what it would mean. And they had hundreds of NGOs signing onto this, who included groups that we didn't know. I think I also want to shift us slightly to other aspects of the Repair Coalition. And although reparations is something that comes up and is part of the agenda and has been taken up by these cities and states, for a lot of the groups in the Repair Alliance, there are, you know, the three basic issues are still there of securing voting rights, because voting suppression has happened, reforming the criminal justice and policing systems, because we've seen the visual images of these of the shootings by police officers of African Americans has huge resonance, and core economic issues about access to labor markets, inequalities. The Federal Reserve figures last week about unemployment showed that there's still a significant difference between unemployment levels amongst white Americans and African Americans, even at this stage with a tight labor market. And income and health disparities are very, very profound still across different groups. So those are sort of the meat issues, bread and butter meat issues of the Repair Alliance. It hasn't gone away. But these other aspects of it are part of it. And obviously the issue of reparations is one that gets its credibility and credence from the record of economic inequality and the historical legacies of enslavement. Enslavement may seem like a long time ago, 150 years ago. But the effects that segregation policy, which replaced enslavement, had on housing markets, labor markets, schools, is very profound. And as you know, Ursula, from your work, there's a lot of important debates about the issue of schools desegregation and integration, where, again, because of the Supreme Court's decisions in the 1990s, schools have really resegregated racially, which is an extraordinary development in this century, given the efforts put into trying to reform and the Department of Education requiring integration plans and so forth. We've really seen significant steps back from that level of achievement.
Thank you, Des, for reminding us that we're not focusing just here on the reparations issue when we're talking about the Repair Alliance, but actually a much broader set of issues to do with economic equality and to do with segregation of schooling segregation and so on. And also, I think the legacies, I think you're quite right to point out of slavery and of segregation. And we know that there are still differences in racial attitudes between areas of the country where slavery was most prevalent, even within the South, compared to places like Asheville, actually, that you mentioned before as being one of your the reparations efforts, that actually that is also a place of relatively liberal racial attitudes, and a place where there were fewer slaves back 150 odd years ago. And so I think we're right here to draw attention to that broader set of issues, and also the continuing legacy of these both of these policy alliances need to continue to wrestle with. And I want to bring us now up to some of the things that are going on right as we record this conversation, and in particular, the polling that shows that Donald Trump is leading Joseph Biden in most, if not all, of the swing states. And I wondered whether, I know that in the book you have a really quite a powerful chapter on the Trump administration and how the Trump administration affected the Protect Alliance during his first presidency. I wondered, Rogers, whether you might comment on some of the things that the Trump administration did for the and with the Protect Alliance, but also what a possible a second Trump presidency might look like for your framework.
The prospects are daunting if one's committed to egalitarian racial progress, frankly. It is important to understand, you referred earlier to the fact that Trump actually has gained support, not only amongst Latinos, but amongst Black Americans. And that is, in many respects, despite the Protect policies of the Trump administration. It is important to understand that members of the Repair Coalition now focus not only on the legacies of slavery and Jim Crow, but what they see as ongoing contemporary policies and practices that discriminate against African Americans. And many were disappointed by the performance of the Obama administration, the housing crisis that occurred when Obama came into office hit most hard on African Americans and greatly limited their homeowning, and that is the greatest source of wealth for most Americans, or at least it traditionally has been. In those regards, the conditions of African Americans actually worsened under the Obama administration. And when Trump came into office, his appointees pursued a whole range of policies that were on their face hostile to the interests of African Americans, like weakening the enforcement of civil rights laws, abandoning efforts to investigate violent white nationalist groups, and working to end efforts at integrated housing, fighting affirmative action in hiring and education, and much more. But the Trump administration did pass the First Step Act, which led to the decarceration of many African Americans, and that was well received by the Black community, even though Trump has now backed away from it a little bit. And he supported lots of funding for HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities. And American unemployment went down in the Trump administration. And even though the disparity between whites and Blacks continued, Black unemployment got down to low levels. It's still at low levels now, but often in jobs that aren't paying very well, and the damaging effects of the loss of homeownership for Black communities has not been overcome. And for those reasons, there's been a slight uptick. It's greatly exaggerated in some reporting, but there is a slight uptick in African-American support for Trump, and that, along with increased Latino support, does mean that it's going to be a very competitive election, with Trump having a chance to win, even though Biden has been making slight gains in the polls most recently. Now, if Trump comes in for a second term, it is going to be a much more militant set of protect policies than we saw in the first term. Trump didn't expect to win the election, initially was somewhat at sea and is a very erratic guy anyway. And the more traditional Republicans, establishment Republicans that did appoint to a number of offices, moderated some of Trump's tendencies during the first couple of years of his administration. He's dumped all those people at this point. He is scarred, embittered, and determined that if he is in office, he's promised retribution. He has indicated that he's going to continue to not only purge the Republican Party, but to purge the federal bureaucracy of anybody that he thinks is not fully on board with a Trump agenda. And that agenda is going to pursue policies to benefit traditionalist Americans, disproportionately white Christian Americans, much more than any other group. That is on a whole range of issues, especially ones Des touched on, like criminal justice, voting rights, important to consolidate power for what is really a minority, a strong but minority coalition. And Hill's economic measures will continue to favor wealthier Americans. But there will also be this effort to control American educational and cultural institutions in order to convey the protect narrative at American of American history. And while there are people of color who embrace that narrative, there are many more that rightly see it as assigning them subordinate places and as championing the identities and interests of those who have traditionally been dominant in American society. So, and of course, there will be a militant anti-immigrant set of policies, and the Repair Coalition has sought to include immigrants from the outset, especially immigrants of color. So a Trump administration will be the protect agenda on steroids. Again, that's not promising for racial progress in the United States.
Thank you for that rather sobering portrait. Des?
Just two things to add. One is we shouldn't underestimate the significance of rhetoric and the language that's been used. And one of the reasons why we've written this project and written the book and undertaken this project is because there was a view, certainly by the end of the last century, that the so-called, what's called the racial card, using implicit tropes to impute racist values to your opponents or to convey that you held certain views, had really diminished quite significantly in presidential politics. And there's a very famous case of Barack Obama's opponent, John McCain, the Republican John McCain, refusing to endorse a racist trope. That's sort of gone. And the level of rhetoric, which is which calls on very traditional eugenic-style language about the United States under the Protect Alliance, is really quite remarkable. And the other point I wanted to make is that there is an important group of thinkers called Afro-pessimists, who are African-American intellectuals and leaders who are not in the repair alliance because they think that they're not opposed to, but they just think that it's never going to make substantial progress. And the fact you have a constant struggle over voting rights, that there are Republican state legislatures prepared to engage in voter suppression, explicit voter suppression, is indicative of a political culture which is perhaps beyond reform. And this is a self-styled group of thinkers called Afro-pessimists, and that's a very important strand.
Thank you. And I found it very interesting in your book to read a bit about some of those concerns. And I think this leads me quite neatly on to my very final question for you both. And that is concerned with the scenarios that you outline at the end of your book for the possible future of America's racial politics. And I wonder if, Des, you might tell us a bit about those, and in particular to tell us whether we have any hope to offer for those who are fearful about the future of American democracy, amidst rising partisan polarization, many of the dynamics that both you and Rogers have described, some of the rising in economic inequality, the sort of crisis of governance in Congress, the Trump administration's disregard for the rule of law, the concern about the system of election administration, the declining trust in those systems and in those institutions more broadly. I mean, the list could go on, but do you have any hope for us? Or is this ultimately a very pessimistic and sobering story?
Not desperately hopeful. I think we would want to, if again, taking the last couple of decades as the trajectory, Ursula, it's really been one that's eroded the civil rights agenda and has brought the protect agenda onto a stronger footing. Now, some members of the Protect Coalition are aware that they can't ignore how multicultural America is and how important, as you raised earlier, for instance, the percentage of Latino voters are to this country. And this has led to a sort of multicultural protect conservatism grouping, which Rogers and I can say a bit more about. Other scenarios include a longstanding hope amongst progressives that there'll be a class race alliance, which will become a sufficient support, electoral majority to introduce some of the changes we've been talking about. There's also a hope that there might be just a simple class-centered progressivism, and that's something that important intellectual leaders like Adolf Reed have been pushing for a long time. But we think the efforts on the protect side to build what's called, and it's a little internally contradictory, a multicultural protect conservatism is probably the most likely. We do have to talk worryingly about the significance of violence and the extent to which this has become a possible scenario in the United States. It's happened. There is a lot of violence that is based on the conflict between protect and repair alliances. We do suggest, and critics may challenge us for this, we do think this comes much more from the protect side than from the conservative side. And looking at the data that's been collected, and we put some of this in the book, simply in measurable terms, protect alliance, such as the militia groups or these racist shooters and so forth, are on that in that alliance, and there is much less evidence that we can find for violence coming from the Repair Coalition, the Repair Alliance. So there are, I think, broadly we talk about six alliances, but the six scenarios, possibly occurring. I think broadly we would say there's going to be a protect effort to build multiculturalism, but without really giving any special treatment to groups within that framework. There will be continuing progressive efforts to build something that is more social democratic in appearance. There is also a significant intersectionality grouping in the US, particularly on the repair side. And then there is just more of what we saw at the end of the Trump administration and the sorts of clashes that we've had since then. Rogers probably wants to, if you've got 1 minute to add.
Well, I'll just add that we do see a kind of multicultural protect conservatism in which all racial, ethnic, and religious groups are welcome so long as they support conservative social and economic policies as the most likely outcome of the current structure of American politics, including its racial politics. But it's by no means inevitable. It's important to recognize that Donald Trump has never won a majority of the popular vote in his elections, and that in 2022, MAGA Republicans did much worse than expected, and Democrats did much better. There is still a very great possibility that Joe Biden will be reelected. Most Americans, I'd say the overwhelming majority of Americans, they certainly do not embrace an extreme white Christian nationalist and violent image of what their country should be and what their future should be. There are great challenges in putting together the more diverse coalition for repair policies and featuring those policies, largely ones about economic interests and democratic rights that have broad appeal to most Americans. But there is real potential to define and advance those policies in ways that mean that while we may not fulfill the most radical aspirations of the Repair Coalition, America will elect governors that governing officials that continue to pursue equitable racial progress in America. We don't think that that is at all guaranteed, but we also don't think it's impossible. And I'd add that we both think it's very much worth trying for.
On that note, thank you both very much for this conversation. It's been enormously illuminating. The book, everybody, is America's New Racial Battle Lines, Protect versus Repair. Do go and buy the book. And thank you, Rogers and Des, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Ursula.